The sharp pain was the shock of discovering simultaneously that this was the man he longed to see more than any other being in the world, and that he had to hope that this man was dead. He did not know why, when the telephone rang and his secretary told him that Miss Dagny Taggart was on the line, why he seized the receiver with eagerness and noticed that his hand was trembling. She would never want to see him again, he had thought for over a year. He heard her clear, impersonal voice asking for an appointment to see him. "Yes, Miss Taggart. Certainly, yes, indeed. Monday morning? Yes. Look, Miss Taggart, I have an engagement in New York today. I could drop in at your office this afternoon, if you wish." "No, no, no trouble at all. I'll be delighted." "This afternoon, Miss Taggart, about 2. I mean, about 4 o'clock. He had no engagement in New York. He did not give himself time to know what had prompted him to do it. He was smiling eagerly, looking at a patch of sunlight on a distant hill. Dagny drew a black line across train number 93 on the schedule and felt a moment's desolate satisfaction in noting that she did it calmly. It was an action which she had had to perform many times in the last 6 months. It had been hard at first. It was becoming easier. The day would come, she thought, when she would be able to deliver that death stroke even without the small salute of an effort. Train number 93 was a freight that had earned its living by carrying supplies to Hammondsville, Colorado. She knew what steps would come next. First, the death of the special freight, then the shrinking in the number of boxcars for Hammondsville, attached, like poor relatives, to the rear end of freights bound for other towns. Then the gradual cutting of the stops at Hammondsville Station from the schedules of the passenger trains. Then the day when she would strike Hammondsville, Colorado, off the map. That had been the progression of Wyatt Junction, and of the town called Stockton. She knew, once word was received, that Lawrence Hammond had retired, that it was useless to wait, to hope, and to wonder whether his cousin, his lawyer, or a committee of local citizens would reopen the plant. She knew it was time to start cutting the schedules. It had lasted less than 6 months after Ellis Wyatt had gone, that period which a columnist had gleefully called the field day of the little fellow. Every oil operator in the country who owned 3 wells and whined that Ellis Wyatt left him no chance of livelihood, had rushed to fill the hole which Wyatt had left wide open. They formed leagues, cooperatives, associations. They pooled their resources and their letterheads. "The little fellow's day in the sun," the columnist had said. Their sun had been the flames that twisted through the derricks of Wyatt Oil. In its glare they made the kind of fortunes they had dreamed about, fortunes requiring no competence or effort. Then their biggest customers, such as power companies who drank oil by the trainful and would make no allowances for human frailty, began to convert to coal, and the smaller customers, who were more tolerant, began to go out of business. The boys in Washington imposed rationing on oil and an emergency tax on employers to support the unemployed oil field workers. Then a few of the big oil companies closed down. Then the little fellows in the sun discovered that a drilling bit which had cost $100 now cost them $500, there being no market for oil field equipment, and the suppliers having to earn on one drill what they had earned on 5 or perish. Then the pipelines began to close, there being no one able to pay for their upkeep. Then the railroads were granted permission to raise their freight rates, there being little oil to carry, and the cost of running tank trains having crushed 2 small lines out of existence. And when the sun went down, they saw that the operating costs, which had once permitted them to exist on their 60-acre fields, had been made possible by the miles of Wyatt's hillside, and had gone in the same coils of smoke. Not until their fortunes had vanished and their pumps had stopped did the little fellows realize that no business in the country could afford to buy oil at the price it would now take them to produce it. Then the boys in Washington granted subsidies to the oil operators. But not all of the oil operators had friends in Washington, and there followed a situation which no one cared to examine too closely or to discuss. Andrew Stockton had been in the sort of position which most of the businessmen envied. The rush to convert to coal had descended upon his shoulders like a weight of gold. He had kept his plant working around the clock, running a race with next winter's blizzards, casting parts for coal-burning stoves and furnaces. There were not many dependable foundries left, He had become one of the main pillars supporting the cellars and kitchens of the country. The pillar collapsed without warning. Andrew Stockton announced that he was retiring, closed his plant, and vanished. He left no word on what he wished to be done with the plant, or whether his relatives had the right to reopen it. There still were cars on the roads of the country, but they moved like travelers in the desert, who ride past the warning skeletons of horses bleached by the sun. They moved past the skeletons of cars that had collapsed on duty and had been left in the ditches by the side of the road. People were not buying cars any longer, and the automobile factories were closing. But there were men still able to get oil by means of friendships that nobody cared to question. These men bought cars at any price demanded. Lights flooded the mountains of Colorado from the great windows of the plant where the assembly belts of Lawrence Hammond poured trucks and cars to the sidings of Taggart Transcontinental. The word that Lawrence Hammond had retired came when least expected, brief and sudden, like the single stroke of a bell in a heavy stillness. A committee of local citizens was now broadcasting appeals on the radio, begging Lawrence Hammond, wherever he was, to give them permission to reopen his plant. There was no answer. She had screamed when Ellis Wyatt went. She had gasped when Andrew Stockton retired. When she heard that Lawrence Hammond had quit, she asked impassively, "Who's next?" "No, Miss Taggart, I can't explain it," the sister of Andrew Stockton had told her on her last trip to Colorado 2 months ago. "He never said a word to me, and I don't even know whether he's dead or living, same as Ellis Wyatt. No, nothing special had happened the day before he quit. I remember only that some man came to see him on that last evening, a stranger I'd never seen before. They talked late into the night. When I went to sleep, the light was still burning in Andrew's study." People were silent in the towns of Colorado. Dagny had seen the way they walked in the streets, past their small drug stores, hardware stores, and grocery markets, as if they hoped that the motions of their jobs would save them from looking ahead at the future. She, too, had walked through those streets, trying not to lift her head, not to see the ledges of sooted rock and twisted steel which had been the Wyatt oil fields. They could be seen from many of the towns. When she had looked ahead, she had seen them in the distance. One well on the crest of the hill was still burning. Nobody had been able to extinguish it. She had seen it from the streets, a spurt of fire, twisting convulsively against the sky as if trying to tear loose. She had seen it at night across the distance of 100 clear black miles from the window of a train, a small violent flame waving in the wind. People called it Wyatt's torch. The longest train on the John Galt line had 40 cars. The fastest ran at 50 miles an hour. The engines had to be spared. They were coal-burning engines, long past their age of retirement. Jim obtained the oil for the diesels that pulled the Comet, and a few of their transcontinental freights. The only source of fuel she could count on and deal with was Ken Daniger of Daniger Coal in Pennsylvania. Empty trains clattered through the four states that were tied as neighbors to the throat of Colorado. They carried a few carloads of sheep, some corn, some melons, and an occasional farmer with an overdressed family who had friends in Washington. Jim had obtained a subsidy from Washington for every train that was run, not as a profit-making carrier, but as a service of public equality. It took every scrap of her energy to keep trains running through the sections where they were still needed, in the areas that were still producing. But on the balance sheets of Taggart Transcontinental, the checks of Jim's subsidies for empty trains bore larger figures than the profit brought by the best freight train of the busiest industrial division. Jim boasted that this had been the most prosperous 6 months in Taggart history. Listed as profit on the glossy pages of his report to the stockholders was the money he had not earned, the subsidies for empty trains, and the money he did not own, the sums that should have gone to pay the interest and the retirement of Taggart bonds, the debt which, by the will of Wesley Mooch, he had been permitted not to pay. He boasted about the greater volume of freight carried by Taggart trains in Arizona, where Dan Conway had closed the last of the Phoenix Durango and retired, and in Minnesota, where Paul Larkin was shipping iron ore by rail, and the last of the ore boats on the Great Lakes had gone out of existence. "You have always considered money-making as such an important virtue," Jim had said to her with an odd half-smile. "Well, it seems to me that I'm better at it than you are."